Welcome to a special year-end edition of Freedom Watch, as your night watchmen bring you the year in liberty. Tonight we look back on the year that was 2011, with Thomas Jefferson's prescient observation in mind. The natural progress of things is for liberty to yield and government to gain ground. As yet, our spirits are free. Jefferson wrote those words in 1788 as the Constitution was in the process of ratification by the states. His concern was that the Constitution may not have gone far enough to restrain the natural growth of government. And looking at the size of government more than 230 years later, in the year 2011, Jefferson was right. 2011 gave us an economy on the brink and a government that pushed its debts to over $15 trillion. It gave us a Congress divided between the big government party on one hand and a renegade class of House freshmen on the other. It was a year of near government shutdowns, of protests and scandals that rocked the nation. America is now at war around the globe, while our civil liberties have been jeopardized here at home as never before. These have certainly been the days that try men's souls. How much has liberty yielded, and how much ground has government gained? First, we look to the economic recovery that wasn't. The Obama administration declared the summer of 2010. You remember this? The summer of economic recovery. 1 year later, is that recovery working out? For answers, I turn to my freedom fighters tonight. Joining me are Peter Suderman, Reason Magazine Associate Editor, Lenore Hawkins, Emeritus Financial Advisor, and James Otteson, Yeshiva University Professor of Economics and Philosophy. So the president went to Kansas. He went to a place that hasn't voted for a Democrat for president in 100 years, compared himself to Teddy Roosevelt, Peter Suderman, and said, the only way to fix this economy is for the government to borrow money it doesn't intend to pay back and spend it. What kind of sense does that make?
That doesn't make much sense at all. I mean, we've seen the non-effects of the stimulus. We've seen the promises that they've made about the stimulus and how many jobs it was going to create before. And so far, there's no good evidence that the stimulus created as many jobs as all the government reports are claiming and as all of these politicians are saying that the stimulus created.
Can the president make a serious argument that 2010 was a year of recovery?
No, he can hope that it was a year of recovery, but the entire policy of taking sand, imagine you're on a beach and you're going to take sand from one place and move it to another and pile it up and say, look at the big pile of sand we have. We have all new sand.
Don't
look at the hole I just dug. This is the entire shell game that's going on with the entire notion of stimulus. Stimulus from the government cannot work. The government is not creating productive wealth. It's moving wealth around from one place to another. It never will create new wealth. It can't do it.
The president says that if the government were to leave people alone and let the forces of the free market play out, let the free choices of consumers and investors, the laws of supply and demand work the way they work, that would be, quote, wrong. What doesn't he understand, Lenore?
Well, the president is mistaken in thinking that it is the president or the federal government's role to decide what is the optimal level of income distribution in the country. The only role for the federal government is to provide an environment for success, not to decide how that success is to be distributed.
Now, I agree, and I suspect you do, Peter, with everything Lenore just said. But are we really ever going to have, in the lifetime of anybody at this table, a federal government that respects the free market that way? I mean, what is the best that we can hope for? I mean, suppose Mitt Romney runs against Barack Obama, or worse yet, Newt Gingrich. What hope is there for the free market?
So I like to think of myself as an optimist in most ways, but on this, I'm a little pessimistic, I have to say. You know, I think the best that we can hope for is that the government doesn't spend, way more than it takes in, that we get something close to a balanced budget, and then we get regulation that's not too onerous. If we got that, it'd be a lot better than the situation we're in now.
What is it about government that it can't understand economics 101? I mean, if we had all Ron Pauls or Ayn Rands in the Congress, oh, what a dream. I can understand, they would understand economics 101. But something seems to happen to people when they get in the government, that they have to appear to be spending money as if that was going to make us richer. As Ron Paul has pointed out, if printing money made us richer, the government could just print away and we'd all be rich, but it doesn't work.
Well, and that's essentially what we're doing, isn't it? This is one of the ways we're going to try to get out of this mess, is by printing money. But look, in the 19th century, a famous person said, power corrupts. That's what happens. We get in a position of power and we use it. We abuse it. And one of the ways we can use it and abuse it is by taking things from one group of people and giving them to another.
I know you're not a constitutional scholar. You're a manager of other people's money. But isn't that the reason that we have a constitution, to prevent the government from picking winners and losers, to prevent the government from taking money from Peter and giving it to you because it needs your political allegiance?
Exactly.
I know he's rich. That's why I said that.
We should talk. Exactly. The only reason that the federal government exists is to protect the rights given to us under the Constitution. The government is a very poor fiduciary. It does not do a good job of deciding who should be the winners and losers. Solyndra gave us an example of how good it is at that.
Well, what are your, I know you're a professor of economics, and your charts and statistics and arrows and diagrams tell you what's going to happen between now and Election Day, Jim Otteson.
What's going to happen to the economy?
Yes.
It's not going to get better. I don't think it's going to get better. And here's one reason to think about this. We never think about, we talk about the debt, but it's very hard to imagine what the debt really is. Judge, we're spending $25 million a minute further into debt. Every minute we're sitting around here talking is another $25 million
of debt. $25 million is money we're borrowing or printing. It's not money we've collected in revenue.
No, absolutely not. This is beyond the money we're collecting in revenue. This is more debt that somebody in the future, some magical pot of gold, is going to have to pay for in the future.
All right. Washington, D.C. treated American citizens and the rest of the world watching to a debt ceiling circus this year. The big government party went into full on fear-mongering mode as it tried to convince House GOP freshmen that a financial Armageddon would surely follow if Congress didn't raise our country's legal borrowing limit by an incredible $2.4 trillion. The ceiling was reached, breached, and ultimately raised. Standard & Poor's downgraded the federal government's credit rating for the first time in American history. And the corrosive spend cycle continues. It is a corrosive cycle that's not likely to end, no matter which party runs either house of Congress. Am I right?
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, you look at the balanced budget proposal, the cut, cap, and balance that the Republicans put forward. It exempts entitlements. It exempts defense spending, Medicare, Social Security, the military. These are the biggest budget items. No. How are you going to balance the budget? Does it really count you're cutting them out?
We spend about $1 trillion a year in entitlements. We spend about $800 billion a year. You could say it's $1 trillion because a lot of defense money is parked into other budgets like the State Department and the intelligence agencies. So two-thirds of what we spend is something that they don't want to touch. Does anybody, except perhaps Ron Paul and Rand Paul, seriously take and understand, anybody in the government, in the Congress, the issue of debt?
I don't think so. And Congress has put themselves into an impossible situation because most of those in Congress believe that it is the moral obligation for the government to continue to spend more, that it is the only way that many of our social and fiscal problems
can
be solved.
Okay, I want to stop you right there because you teach philosophy as well as economics.
Right.
Why do people think that things are going to get better when the government appears to be spending money on them? Does everybody, even a Thomas Jefferson among us, want their piece of the government pie?
Well, this is how it seems to work, doesn't it, Judge? I'm going to give you some bad news. You go into your average college campus and you ask students, what is the purpose of the government? What they will not say is to protect our natural rights. They will not say what John Locke said, that the chief purpose of the government is to protect property. What they will say is to take care of the problems. Mm. Once you have the idea that the government's job is to take care of whatever the problems are, well, this is what you're going to get.
So we have gone from Jefferson's, that government is best which governs least, to Lincoln's, the job of the government is to do for the people what they can't do for themselves in their own individual capacities. That is a radical 180-degree departure. I suppose you could put some ruffles and flourishes on there from Woodrow Wilson and Theodore Roosevelt and FDR and Barack Obama, but it's certainly going in the direction of big government and not small government. Even in the years Republicans were in power, Peter Suderman.
Republicans were terrible big spenders. I mean, the Bush era was an era of big government when Republicans controlled Congress, controlled the White House. They spent and they spent. They passed a brand new entitlement.
Right, right.
Medicare Part D.
Medicare Part D. Why do you think, Lenore Hawkins, that so many of the small government freshman Republicans in the House, without whom John Boehner would be Minority Leader Boehner instead of Speaker Boehner, caved and voted to let the president borrow $2.4 trillion. Can you imagine what would have happened if they hadn't done that? And the government, for the first time in modern times, was forced to live within its means? Why do you think they caved?
We had a brief moment of hope that was quickly dashed. I think there's two main reasons. One, they're nervous. They don't really know how it all works, and it's easy to get pressured. But I think a lot of it is once you get to D.C., you start drinking the Kool-Aid that D.C. has to justify its own existence. D.C. has to be able to tell the rest of the world, here's all the things we're going
to
do
for you. To give the impression that it's doing something.
Yes, it's actually accomplishing something so it can continue to grow, because everybody wants to increase their scope of responsibility.
Did the federal government deserve the credit? Do you remember this brouhaha? The credit downgrade that it got from they practically wanted to arrest the officers of Standard & Poor's. Did the government deserve that downgrade?
Is there anybody who thinks that the United States government is really fiscally solvent? I mean, there is we are a sovereign nation. We can print our own money. So there's a sense in which we can print forever, and we are so far over our skis. But I think the real reason people got so upset about the downgrade was because the whole world pegs itself to the United States. If the United States, which has created more wealth than any country in the history of humankind, if the United States is over its skis, then what? I think there's just such a tremendous fear of the uncertainty of what could lie in the future. If that's the case, we just don't want to face it.
I think people got upset over the downgrade because it told them a painful truth. Mm-hmm. Hang out, guys. We'll be back after the break. The revolution continues here on Freedom Watch in just a moment. If 2010 was the year of the Tea Party, then 2011 might well have been the year of the protesters. Major protests kicked off in Wisconsin in response to legislation signed by Republican Governor Scott Walker to curb the collective bargaining rights of public sector unions. Though to call them rights is a gross manipulation of the English language, as it would be more properly expressed as collective bargaining power, as in the power to bar an employer, in this case the state government, from employing anyone outside the public sector union. Then later in the year, those infamous Occupy Wall Street movement folks gained steam across the country, protesting the rise of corporatism and crony capitalism, among other things. But were these left-wing protest movements a sign of a mood swing back to the left, or just an outburst of anger from powerful interest groups? I'm joined again by my freedom fighters, Peter Suderman, Reason Magazine Associate Editor. Joining us now, Nicole Neely, Executive Director of the Independent Women's Forum, and still with us, Professor Jim Otteson from the Yeshiva University Department of Economics and Philosophy. Nicole, we'll start with you. What happened to the Tea Party? Did it sort of go away? We celebrated it in 2010. Did we even hear about it in 2011?
No, we haven't heard a ton about them because a lot of them got elected. They had this big wave that pushed, obviously, Speaker Boehner into office, and they have been wrestling with the problems of trying to govern. And getting to Washington and trying to deal with that burden, I think, has been a rough adjustment for a lot of them. But we have seen a lot of their voices holding Republicans accountable for many of their decisions. I think we saw them keeping the Republicans on task for spending, for the debt ceiling, for tax hikes, much more than if they had not run.
Don't they always seem to cave, Peter Suderman? Don't they always seem to march to the drum that the leadership beats? I mean, if those 80 or so Tea Party freshmen had stuck to their guns, that debt ceiling would not have passed.
You know, I don't know if that's always true. Certainly, it's frequently true. But look, in 2010, the Tea Party told us over and over again what they were against. But now in 2011, they've got to figure out what they're for. And that's a lot harder to do. And that, I think, is why we're seeing a little more reticence. But what we know now, actually, is that one of the things they're against is Mitt Romney. And so you can see the Tea Party's influence in the GOP primary, looking for alternatives to Mitt Romney.
How about I'm for a government that stays within the confines of the Constitution? How about I'm for the free market? How about I'm for the laws of supply and demand? How about I'm for getting rid of most of the 4,200 federal statutes that regulate almost everything we do every day?
Well, that's a long way to go from where we are now, Judge. I mean, I think that's one of the problems. We got a glimmer of the American spirit of liberty from the Tea Party.
Right.
But then you also start thinking, people say to themselves, well, wait a minute, I do kind of want my Medicaid, and I do kind of want my Social Security, and, well, I want you people to pay for it, but I want to keep getting my benefits, and that's a problem.
Do you think there's something about renegades getting into power? Almost a classic example was Newt Gingrich when he led the revolution of 1994 and suddenly realized he was the third-ranking official of the federal government. And if he shrank the federal government, he would shrink his own power. Yeah. Did that happen to these Tea Party folks when they went from being insurgents to being incumbents?
A little bit. I think it's that the adage of basically coming to the swamp and finding out that it's not really a swamp. It's sort of more like a hot tub once you're in the water a little bit. You know.
Boy.
But,
I knew
the government
was bad, but is it that bad?
I don't like that image.
Some of them have been co-opted. Some of them have been moved to leadership positions. I mean, remember when the Republicans first came to power, that every single bill that they brought was going to be constitutional and was going to deal with jobs.
It hasn't been the case. Wisconsin, as we speak, Governor Walker is resisting a very, very serious effort to recall him. I think that's the word there, not impeach him. He's going to be recalled because of the perception on the part of his employees, the people that work for the state, that he took away from them something that his predecessors gave. Is it a good thing or a bad thing?
I think, you know, democracies, activists, protesters, whoever they are, left, right, libertarian, anarchist, whatever they are, you always have a right to express yourself. And absolutely we should be protective of that right. And, you know, it's a good thing when people understand that it's okay for them to speak up.
You live and work here in New York City, which was ground zero for Occupy Wall Street. Mm-hmm. We sent some of our producers down there. They came back with kids wearing Don't Tread on Me and Ron Paul buttons. Mm-hmm. And we have tape of them chanting, end the Fed, end the wars. Right. Of course, then some of them said, end the IRS, and others want to use the IRS to punish success. What do you make of this Occupy Wall Street? And why would Mrs. Pelosi and the president try to get their arms around this ragtag group?
Well, that's an interesting question. They're looking for a constituency. All of the other constituencies are floating away from them, so they've got to find a constituency. But, I mean, it's a ragtag bunch. There's a hodgepodge of things they're interested in. One of the things that distinguishes them from the Tea Party is the worry about equality. They're worried about growing inequality, and that's something that does call to a deep moral aspect of humanity.
Do you agree with me that some of their complaints are legitimate? They're complaining about the government giving money to big banks. They should complain to the government, not to the banks. But the reason a lot of them don't have jobs is because of not enough capitalism sapped by the government. Would you agree with those complaints?
I do. I think that the Occupy Wall Street movement needs to realize that they have a lot in common with the Tea Party. They don't like corporatism. They don't like crony capitalism. I mean, we haven't had a free market healthcare system in, you know, 100 years. I mean, so I think that there is a lot in common, and there is a growing dissatisfaction with what created the problem. Government created the problem. We should be occupying the capital. We shouldn't be occupying Wall Street.
Got it. Agreed. Guys, thanks very much for joining us. Please stick around. It was a year to remember for political scandals, although many of the administration would rather forget them. The year in political scandals. That's next. Scandals are drawn to Washington like flies to garbage. And this year was no difference. The biggest surprise came early this summer when the feisty up-and-coming Democratic Congressman Anthony Weiner, who could forget him, admitted to sending a series of inappropriate pictures of himself over Twitter. The White House understandably kept its distance from Congressman Weiner. But that did not save it from its own emerging scandal. One scandal cost the taxpayers, you, billions of dollars in Energy Department loans to failed green energy companies like Solyndra. The other cost people their lives. To review these political scandals, I turn back to my freedom fighters. Peter Suderman, Reason Magazine Associate Editor, Lenore Hawkins, Meritus Financial Advisor, and Nicole Neely, Executive Director of the Independent Women's Forum. Lenore, arguably the most tragic scandal was from the ATF, which resulted in the death of border agent Brian Terry. Everybody remembers this one. The government decided that it could find out which bad guys had guns by letting them get the guns. 2,000 machine gun, military-grade weapons disappeared. The government kept no records, but they know that bullets from one of them were at the murder scene of Agent Terry. How bad is this?
Oh, this is horrible. And it just goes to show that we need to think twice before we grant our government additional powers. These people are no different from us. They have oftentimes poorer judgment because they can actually get away with some of this inane behavior.
Does it trouble you when the government breaks its own laws? It'll break law A in order to enforce law B. I mean, one of the statutory obligations of the ATF, it's got different names. We all call it ATF. It used to be alcohol, tobacco, firearms. Now I think they've added explosives to it, is to keep these weapons away from bad guys. The government actually facilitated these weapons getting in the hands of some of the most dangerous drug cartels the world has ever known. How can the government get away with breaking its own laws?
You mean why we seceded from England, that that no monarch was ever above the law.
Right.
That is absolutely concerning. And I think what has also started to come out is that they started to do this scandal sort of as a straw man argument to enforce stronger gun regulations, which, as a Second Amendment fan, I find also really insulting.
Is the Anthony Weiner scandal a big deal, or was it just the absurd, bizarre behavior of one sort of loud-mouthed, very liberal, he was here all the time, he loved to argue, God bless him, member of Congress?
I think it was a great political circus. It was a lot of entertainment. If you enjoy politics as entertainment, as a reality show with hot tubs, maybe not with the hot tubs, but there should have been
that
one.
Hot tub
there should have been
Nicole.
One. I mean, if you enjoy politics that way, then that was great fun.
Did this hurt the Democratic Party, or did they quite properly distance themselves from him? I mean, he had no defenders. They must have called him up and said, get the heck out of here, resign right now. You're not going to put us through a public hearing about you taking pictures of yourself at the gym.
Yes, Weiner, the shot that launched 1,000 puns,
right,
the gift
right.
that keeps on giving. I don't think it really hurt the Democrats, because sadly, this is what we have come to expect from those in political power.
Also in the Weiner vein, though not nearly as seriously, and he didn't lose his job over it, were the allegations against Herman Cain. Some of workplace harassment, which is a violation of federal and local statutes. Some of just having a perfectly lawful adult relationship, but while he was married, one that he publicly denied. Should he have left the campaign because of these things, or should he have done what Arnold Schwarzenegger did, sort of laughed it off and said, yes, it is true. Now let me tell you why I'll be a good governor. What do you think?
You know, I think the Weiner scandal was cauterized pretty early, and the Herman Cain scandal, man, it just dragged on and on, and then there were more women and more women, and certainly I'm all for giving people a fair hearing, but with all the number of women, I think it really did significant long-term damage to the Republicans at a time when they can't afford it.
Here's one that arguably was caused by the White House itself, and that's Solyndra. Now, the statute was enacted in the Bush administration. I'm going to guess that all of us at this table opposed the statute, which basically let the president pick winners and choosers by guaranteeing the debts, the financial obligations of corporations the president likes. So the Department of Energy picks this company, Solyndra. None of us had heard of it before. They made solar panels. Their solar panels were not as good and cost more than the ones imported from China. But one of the president's principal bundlers, people that collect cash and checks for the president, not checks, cash, they don't use, not cash, checks, they don't use cash anymore, was also a principal investor in Solyndra. So did the president pick Solyndra to reward his political contributor with federal money?
I think the scandal there isn't the political contributions, it's not the political connections. The scandal there is the way it shows that the Obama agenda, the Obama green jobs agenda in particular, but just sort of the Obama administration's whole style of picking winners, picking losers, thinking that the government can play venture capitalist, can run the economy, can spend all this money and make things work, it shows exactly why it doesn't.
How did Solyndra play in California? I mean, was the government mocked when Solyndra collapsed?
Oh, absolutely. Here you go, where once again, the politicians are always going to be under pressure to support their cronies.
Right.
And here you've got where political pressures overrode sound judgment, and people lost their jobs, and the American public is left to foot the bill.
Isn't it true that the government will never spend other people's money, and everything the government owns has other people's money, the way you would spend your own? Your model is economic, the government's model is political.
Absolutely. This is what Milton Friedman said. You're going to spend your own money responsibly. You'll spend up someone else's money less responsibly because you don't have skin in the game. With Solyndra, this was imperial hubris. They felt that they actually had the knowledge to beat the market, and that absolute arrogance is what drives me up the wall.
All right, guys. Thanks very much for joining us on this one. Can the president launch a war wherever he wants, whenever he wants, and indefinitely? Certainly this president thinks so. Our panel tackles the Obama wars next. Barack Obama first garnered national attention for his fiery anti-war speeches. He famously called the war in Iraq, this is before he was president, a dumb war. But once in office, he doubled down on Afghanistan, tried to delay the Iraq drawdown negotiated by President Bush, and made 2011 the year of the Obama wars, with American military involvement in Libya, in Uganda, in Pakistan, in Somalia, and add the possibility of a covert war already underway in Iran. We're back with our panel, Nicole Neely, Lenore Hawkins, and joining us now, Freedom Watch regular, retired United States Army Colonel Douglas McGregor. Panel, welcome here. Colonel McGregor, to you first. Big picture, is the average American at Christmas time 2011 safer in our freedoms and in our property rights and in our homes because of all the military adventurism going on around the world in the past 3 or even the past 10 years?
Oh, absolutely not. In fact, we've not only cultivated millions of new enemies overseas as a result of our ill-considered interventions and bad policies, but we've also undermined our national security by spending ourselves into oblivion, losing trillions of dollars on these interventions.
Do we need 900 permanent military installations around the world on which the sun never sets and the location and name of which no single person could possibly ever name?
No, we are paying too high a price in blood. We are paying too high a price in treasure. We can't afford it. We are borrowing money from the Chinese to fund our military adventurism overseas.
Very dangerous, borrowing money from the Chinese to fund our military adventurism overseas. Aren't the Chinese, arguably, someone who have us in their military crosshairs and who we would have in the military crosshairs?
Well, given that we're one of their biggest customers, it wouldn't behoove them to harm us too much. But there's more than one way to take over a country. And certainly by holding the majority of the debt of a country, you have an awful lot of power. I'm not comfortable with what they can do. And here we go to your earlier point. How is it the United States is responsible for half of all the military spending in the entire world?
How did we get to this point, Colonel McGregor, where it's almost deemed unpatriotic if you vote to cut defense spending?
Well, it's not a new phenomenon, but I think you've got to go back to the end of the Second World War. We ended up effectively the last man standing. Everyone else was very weak. We emerged almost unscathed compared to everyone else. Our GNP dominated the world, and at one point it was almost half the gross national product of the world. Today, we've fallen down to less than 20%. Our economic position is far weaker. But in the meantime, we've retained all of these bases. We've retained this equivalent overseas empire because there is a consensus inside the Beltway that keeping American soldiers in other people's countries is the way to promote peace and prosperity.
Right.
And that may have been true during the Cold War when we had a true existential threat to the United States and the West. But it hasn't been true for over 20 years, and it needs to end.
Why wasn't there more of an outrage when the president started a war in Libya on his own? Remember this scenario? Congress was on spring break. Congress gets spring break. Congress was on a spring break. The president was in Brazil, and he announced that he was bombing in Libya, supposedly to save lives. It was a humanitarian mission. It wasn't a war because boots weren't on the ground. They were in the planes in the sky. And by the way, it was under the supervision of NATO anyway. Why did Congress act like a potted plant over that? The president arguably stole their power under the Constitution, their power to declare war.
Yeah, like you said, it wasn't a war. There wasn't, you know, we're funding, we're sending drones, we're striking, we're paying for missiles that NATO's using, but it's not a war. But absolutely, Congress has fully ceded all of their powers. I mean, it is unbelievable. It is antithetical to what our republic was founded as, to allow the president unlimited authority. That was what our founders cautioned against.
What will it take before we realize that we have to pull back financially, we have to reassess even our involvement with NATO, that it is not unpatriotic to say the Pentagon can operate on $600 billion instead of $800 billion?
I think our debt level is probably going to do that. But unfortunately, for the time being, we're the least ugly dog in the ugly dog contest, and all the problems in Europe and eventually in Japan are giving us a little bit of a break there.
Colonel, is it likely that we've started war already in Iran using covert sources, whether they're Americans or not, maybe military out of uniform? Can you tell us what you're allowed to tell us and what you know about what the American military is doing in Iran as we speak?
Well, actually, I can't say very much except to point out that, you know, we maintain surveillance across the region. We're very interested in what happens inside Iran. We're engaged with the Iranians in ways that are similar to how we were engaged with the Soviets during the Cold War, when our nuclear submarines were engaged with their submarines in a cat and mouse game. There's a lot of that happening now in the region. But it's not fundamentally changing anything, and it really isn't helping our position or the position of our friends.
Are you surprised that so many Republican candidates for president have said bring home the troops now, started by Ron Paul, but even Gingrich and Romney jumped on the bandwagon about 2 months ago?
I'm relieved to see it because my brother's one of those soldiers, and I don't want him going out to die for a war without purpose. But it's been interesting to look at the generation gap on how people feel about war issues. Millennials, by 66% in a recent Pew poll, feel that we don't need to expand our might militarily, that doing so actually invites more trouble. And I think as people start to get older and as the silent generation starts to die off, they're gonna have to do that.
Colonel Douglas McGregor, Nicole Neely, Lenore Hawkins, guys, thank you very much. Coming up, the Freedom Fighters will explain why no one in this world, no one, is safe from the President of the United States. That's next. Picture this scenario. An American citizen exercises his First Amendment right to the freedom of speech, but the president believes that his words are actually inciting terrorism. The president doesn't have to prove anything. He merely has to believe this. Next, U.S. drone strikes come crashing through the roof of the American's car, killing him and his teenage son. You would be outraged if this happened here. Now, would it matter to you if this person had a Muslim-sounding last name, for instance, like Anwar al-Awlaki? Would that change your mind on whether this scenario was lawful and constitutional? It shouldn't. Our Constitution was created to protect all persons and guarantees everyone's right to due process under the law. The president has already run roughshod over those rights in the killing of the New Mexico-born Anwar al-Awlaki, and now Congress is busy handing the president even more power to allow the military to arrest Americans in the streets. We're back with our panel, Peter Suderman, Reason Magazine Associate Editor, retired United States Army Colonel Douglas McGregor, and James Otteson, Yeshiva University Professor of Economics and Philosophy. Peter, should the president be impeached for unilaterally murdering an American citizen without a trial, without a charge, without a judge, without a jury, and an utter violation of the Constitution and federal law?
Impeached is a strong action indeed, but he is someone who took strong action himself, and certainly people need to be talking about it more, need to be paying more attention to it. I just don't think it's something that people have paid nearly enough attention to, that the president has basically asserted, as you said, the power to take out anyone that he deems that he has the authority to take out, that he decides.
Are you surprised that in 2011 we're actually seriously debating whether the rule of law is superior to the president or the president is superior to the rule of law? This was a debate Parliament had about the king in 1628.
We've been through this one before, haven't we, Judge?
We have, but why is it that these things keep happening? This so-called liberal professor of constitutional law, lover of liberty, decides he can kill somebody on the basis of secret evidence in America?
It's a frightening prospect. I'm glad you mentioned New Mexico, by the way. That is part of the United States. I myself was born in New Mexico. Yes, that's part of the United States. People in New Mexico are entitled to the same freedoms under the Constitution as every other citizen is supposed to be entitled to. But I think, Judge, what's really going on here is a kind of training in obedience. American citizens are getting trained to be obedient. Look what happens at the TSA with the TSA in the airports. We're all getting trained to be obedient to the authorities. That's
Colonel,
what we're seeing.
Colonel McGregor, what do you suspect would be the reaction of members of the military, all of whom are volunteers today and each of whom is a professional, if the president asked them to restrain or to kill someone without due process, American or not? We're not talking about in the battlefield. We're talking about somebody giving a speech or somebody riding in a car.
Well, most of the members of the armed forces are very uncomfortable interfering in domestic affairs. And that's really what you're talking about. You're talking about suspending the rule of law inside the United States, creating a special category of people, presumably Muslims, who are suspected of terrorism, who can essentially be apprehended or killed at will. That's not something that people in the armed forces want to be involved with. But the issue, unfortunately, really resides with the Congress that has being complicit in all of this, because ultimately the armed forces will obey. They will do what they are asked to do.
I have argued, Peter Suderman, that just because something is legal doesn't make it constitutional. So if the Congress, for example, and they're debating this as we speak, says the president, Colonel McGregor paints a nightmare scenario, but this is one that's actually being debated in the Congress, that the president can use the military to arrest people in the United States and ship them to Guantanamo Bay, and they can't see a lawyer and they'll never see a judge and forget about a jury. Just because it's legal doesn't make it constitutional. The Fifth Amendment couldn't be clearer. No person shall suffer loss of life, liberty, or property without due process of law.
Look, the Constitution was put in place to protect us from unbounded executive power, but Congress has a job to enforce that, and if they don't, there's not a lot to do about it. I mean, it is a nightmare scenario.
When Jay Carney, the president's chief press spokesperson, was asked, how could you justify killing an American? His answer was, well, he waived his own American citizenship by the words he articulated. Yeah. Now, if that's the position the president's going to take, he could make that argument about anybody. He could say that about Mitt Romney. The words he used, waived his American citizenship, I shipped them to Guantanamo Bay.
Right. That could be applied to all sorts of people in the country. Look, the United States has a constitution. There's a question I'd like to ask Mr. Carney and Mr. President. Do we have a constitution or not? You raised your right hand and you swore an oath, and part of that Constitution was the First Amendment. Part of that Constitution was the Fifth Amendment, as you articulated. Do we have it anymore or do we not? Let's ask them the question. Hear what they say.
Whatever you thought, Colonel McGregor, and I know you're a historian as well as a political philosopher, about presidents from FDR to Ronald Reagan, America was decidedly different at its core from Nazi Germany and from the Soviet Union. Those were wars, one hot, one cold, where you could see right and wrong. You could appreciate what the American government was doing. Today, is the American government in danger of becoming similar to the evil empires we have battled against in the past?
Well, we certainly have a lot of evidence that external war is used to justify authoritarian measures at home. Woodrow Wilson's measures were very harsh. After war was declared against Germany, large numbers of people opposed it and were sent to jail. His laws were actually harsher than the Patriot Act and harsher than what we've seen under George Bush. But the bottom line is that as long as we have this sense of an external enemy, real or unreal, and clearly whatever the enemy is, this terrorist enemy, his capabilities have been grossly exaggerated out of all proportion to reality. But as long as that is maintained, the easier it is for people inside the United States and the government to justify the kind of intrusive federal government you're describing.
Got it. Colonel Douglas McGregor, Peter Suderman, Jim Otteson, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining us, guys.
Thank you.